wondering just how many lessons we're going to have. This is lesson two. There's just going to be four lessons in the entire quarter, which is going to be divided up. It's marriage and then divorce and then remarriage, and that's the topic. So, lesson two, as you can tell, we're only on page five, and lesson two goes through page nine. So we're going to take our time, and we can take our time, especially because of the fact that I don't know of much that can be said about remarriage. I mean, there's just not much material in there. But the majority of our time will be spent on marriage and then divorce. And we have to spend some time on divorce, again, not because there's not much in the Scripture to teach about it, but because of all the error that's being taught by brethren. So we really want to, before we go to the other two areas, we really want to make sure we cover all the ins and outs of marriage. Not just the more common passages used about marriage, like Ephesians 5, and we'll talk about that. But all these other, as I see them, these foundational points that we're bringing out from even from the Old Testament. So that's kind of at the pace that we're going. We don't have any reason to be in a hurry. And when the quarter is up, I want us to have covered as fully as we can all this material. All right, we were talking Wednesday night, and it was suggested that we begin here again this morning just as a brief review, and I won't spend a lot of time on this. But we were talking in Genesis 2 and at verse 24, after God has brought the man his helper that was unlike the animals that were around him. And he then, of course, fashioned the helper from Adam's rib. That and Brother Bowen pointed out, and correctly so, Wednesday night, that when Jesus speaks about this in Matthew 19 and Mark 10 as the parallel passage, Jesus says that God said this long ago. And Moses is recording this here in Genesis 2. So we put those two together. We understand that this was God saying this. Even if he didn't actually speak it, it was revealed to Moses the Holy Spirit. But this idea that for this cause a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. We pointed out that this is the marriage, the universal marriage law, universal marriage rule for all time. And one thing that we pointed out is that notice that Adam had no father to leave. So this couldn't have been applicable to him. He couldn't leave his father or his mother. He was the first human. So God is setting forth the rule, if you will. And when it comes time for a young man and a young woman to get married, and they've been through all the courtship and all those things, and they've decided that we want to get married, there's going to have to be some leaving. That was the other point we made. You're going to have to leave father and mother. You're going to have to subjugate that relationship. Not that you won't stop being a son, but that will no longer be your primary relationship. You have to leave them. And the old phrase, you have to cut the apron strings. Sister Curtis approached me after class Wednesday night. She said, I heard of a friend of mine. Her son got married. And she made a present for her soon-to-be daughter-in-law. Had it wrapped up real pretty and gave her this box. And she opened it up and it was an apron. And she had cut the apron strings. And the young lady said, I really appreciated that. That was a kind of a cute gesture. But it's based on this. And she was telling her what? That's right. He belongs to you now. He's still my son, but that's not the primary relationship anymore. He's now your husband. And so that has to take place. And not just a leaving, but also a cleaving. And the word, as we said, points out that there has to be a gluing or a cementing together, a tight bond. The other passages there, and this got us to the end of question seven. These four places in the New Testament where this passage is either quoted or cited, this cleaving, leaving and cleaving, and they shall be one flesh. Yes, Brother Miller. Pardon? Yes. It doesn't make for a good marriage. I mean, it's just a recipe for disaster. There has to be a leaving and then a cleaving. must be that way. God certainly knew what He was doing when He put that law, that rule in place. So this is where we got left off on Wednesday. We'll take up our discussion now in question 8. Still staying now in Genesis 2. Now the last part of verse 24 says that a man shall leave his father and his mother and shall cleave to his wife. And then the last says that they shall become one flesh. And I've asked you in question 8, comment on what you think one flesh means and what all is involved with that. What all has to happen for a man and a woman when they are united in marriage to become one flesh. All right. They are combined together as a unit. What's involved? What's it mean to be one flesh? Well, let's elaborate some of those things. It's not just one, if you ever says, and I would. All right, got to be united. That's right. Now, when we look at this verse, most people, maybe I shouldn't say most, maybe a lot of people, either if they're teaching a class or just studying, they think this refers to what? With the sexual union. And is that involved? Absolutely that's involved, yes, to be one flesh. But it's not just limited to the physical intimacy that may be enjoyed in marriage, being one flesh. Buford says they need to be in one mind. They need to think alike. Yes, Rick. All right. Yes. Absolutely. Ephesians 5 is a wonderful passage that comments on this, I believe. He who loves his wife loves himself. Whoever mistreats his own body, Paul argues. Well, that's why it takes a real man to beat up on a wife, doesn't it? Well, he's not loving his wife, as the Scripture would say. So that's clearly goes against this idea of being one flesh. What else may be involved in being one flesh? Okay. All right. Giving care, giving honor, making some sort of sacrifice on some level, or levels, plural. Each need to do that. That's correct. Does the Bible talk about any other beings being one besides a husband and a wife? All right, yes. I want to draw your attention to some passages in the Gospel of John, chapter 10 and chapter 17, especially chapter 17 when he's praying. He said, I and the Father are what? We're one. Now, they're not married. I'm not suggesting there's a marriage there. But I am saying the Bible talks about the fact that Jesus said He and His Father were united in purpose, in aim, for the redemption, the salvation of mankind. Let's talk about some practical things that a husband and wife would need to be united on. And again, this is a part separate from the marriage bed. Where would it be just absolutely critical and feasible for them to act? Finances. You're going to blend two people together who come from two different backgrounds, and now they've got to live together. And as we said Wednesday night, just because you're one flesh doesn't mean you give up your individual personalities. The Lord never asks us to do that. We still have to think like who we are. And we have to act many times in individualistic ways. And we all understand that. But there's going to have to be some common ground sought. One way in which, as Wayne points out, is finances. How's this family going to spend its money? How many marriages are on the rocks or are broken up over money? Well, there's a bunch of them. Just a ton of them. So that doesn't mean that money's most important, but that is a factor. All right? What else would be a practical way? Yes, Charles? And that will come more into play. Yes, if you take two Christians that marry, what's their goal? What's their aim? I mean, you know, to be united in aim and purpose. What's their goal? Get to heaven. That's right. Well, what if you have a believer married to an unbeliever. They don't have the same goal. Now, hopefully the believer can teach the unbeliever. And used to worship with some brethren. This one brother in particular. I could call his name, but that would mean nothing to you. But anyway, he was so hard line. It is a sin for a Christian to marry an unbeliever. Well, that's what he believed. And we'll talk more about that later. I can't say that's so. I think it's poor judgment. But I can't say it's sinful. Because there are passages in the Scripture that talk about a believer married to an unbeliever. And if it was wrong to do that, then we'd have some problems with some of the apostolic writings. But Charles brings up a good point. And this probably is the most important practical way in the marriage of being one flesh. We've got to be united in the most important thing in life, getting to the same destination when life's over. Right? Any other practical areas? All right. If God blesses this couple with children, there's going to have to be some discussion about how we're going to raise the children. Do people disagree over discipline? Well, they sure do. They sure do. Some are more lax than others. And again, we come from different backgrounds. Maybe one or two of the couple came from a more lenient background. Someone came from a more stringent background. Well, how are we going to harmonize that? Well, we're just going to have to talk about it and find out what the rules are. And then as a family, we decide this is what we're going to allow in this family. This is where we're going to draw the lines in this family. And we're going to have to be consistent. And so those are some practical ways that a couple needs to be one flesh. They need to be one. How many children try to pit mom against dad? Play both ends of both ends against the middle, as the saying is. Well, that happens a lot. But if mom and dad are together in this, then what one says, the other says. And that's not likely. I won't say it won't happen, but it's not likely to happen because they're united in that. Yes, Buford.
Especially true after a marriage split. The children really play their parents.
Yeah, yeah. Yes, that's true. Okay. So this idea of being one flesh, again, maybe the first thought that comes to our mind is the sexual union, and that certainly is biblical. But it's not the only thing that needs to be understood when the passage that gives us the beginning of the home, of the family, talks about being one flesh. Yes, Freddie? Yes, that is true. Even if there's no children come to the union, that is correct. They're still one flesh. And even if they're just dirt poor and had no money, they're still one flesh. You are correct. And what if they're not believers and not headed for heaven? They're still one flesh. That's right. Okay. Anything else, anybody? Yes, Bill. Yes. Yes, absolutely. No polygamy allowed in this. The rule is you cleave to your wife. No dissolving of the union. Ephesians chapter 5 and... Yes. Yes. Right. Yes. Yes. In fact, in verse 32, Paul says, I speak about Christ in the church, but his analogy is the marriage relationship. So there is a lot of parallels there, Charles. You are correct. Okay. Let's look now at question 9. And as we end chapter 2, the physical one flesh, I want to say a few words about what's found in verse 25. What's verse 25 record for us? After she's brought to the man and the man gives his reaction in verse 24, and then Moses writes what he writes in verse 23, and then Moses writes what he writes in verse 24. Then verse 25, what information are we given now? What does it say? All right, they were naked. And what else? They were not ashamed. Now, we understand as one knows the Bible story, what hasn't happened yet. Well, there's no sin. That's just the next chapter, so we understand that. But at this point, they are described as being naked and not being ashamed in that. Now, what I want to do is maybe apply this a little differently. There must be present also between a husband and a wife a close physical intimacy. And I've asked you to look at 1 Corinthians chapter 7, the first part of that chapter. So the question is, you know, besides when it says that they were naked and not ashamed, besides speaking to their innocence, they hadn't yet committed sin, and that hasn't taken place yet. But besides that, I believe this passage also speaks, when you couple it alongside what Paul teaches in 1 Corinthians 7, that is there any shame? And I'll just say it this way. Is there any shame in marital nakedness? And there's none. What is it that Paul argues in 1 Corinthians 7? Starting at the last part of verse 2. Somebody read that for me. 1 Corinthians 7, the last part of verse 2 through verse 4. Bobby, do you have that for us? Paul says something about affection in that passage. The Old King James says, render the due benevolence, or affection. What the affection, he says, is due. What's that saying? You owe it. You pay what you owe. How many marriages have suffered because one or the other was withholding themselves in this area, physically? Happens a lot. That's why Paul says in verses, especially toward the end of verse 4, that what about, you're the wife in this union, what about your body? It's not yours. Now, does that mean that your husband can just do all kinds of things to you? Well, of course not. That doesn't mean that. Ephesians 5, as Rick pointed out, that's brought in. We look at all these together. He who loves his wife loves his own self. That's right. So, but I'm just saying, does that mean when Paul says that your body is not yours, it belongs to your husband, and husband, your body is not yours, it belongs to her? That doesn't mean that you can be used and discarded like a piece of trash. But that means that you owe something physically to this relationship. What is the sexual drive that is in you? It's an appetite. That's really what it is. Now, we all know what that is. We know what an appetite is. We get hungry. All of us get hungry from time to time. We have to have food. We have to eat. Well, what about this appetite? It's going to have to be taken care of. Now, I started out a little later in the passage, and this kind of gets us a little earlier, or on ahead more, to on page 7. I've asked the three reasons why we have marriage. This is one of them. And it's in 1 Corinthians 7. Paul says, in order to avoid what? Avoid fornication, let every man have his own wife, and every woman have her own husband. So who put this sexual appetite in you? Well, God did. But not only did he do that, but what else did he do? He made the place available to have that satisfied legitimately. And that's why, as we have been citing several times, Hebrews 13, verse 4. It's the marriage bed. That's where it's honorable, and that's where it's undefiled. But everywhere else, what did the writer say? It's subject to judgment. It's whoremongering, and it's adultery. Yes, Buford. Yes, that's right, and we'll talk about all that later. You are correct. That's another reason for that ability to have sexual intercourse. So anyway, we're just saying when this chapter concludes that they were naked, they were not ashamed. There is no shame in marital nakedness, none whatsoever. It's a beautiful thing. Those of us that are married, we know what that's about. But outside of marriage, what is it? It's shameful. It's shameful conduct, and it is subject to the judgment of God. And unless one repents of that, we could just pile up the passages that teach that's not correct, that's not proper behavior. And God will judge the impenitent sinner in that area. Okay. Anything else through page 5? Anybody has a comment or a question? Yes. Right. Yes. Yes. They covered themselves. That seemed to be their first thought. So, I would agree that this passage mainly is talking about the sense of shame and sin. But I think there's also something else there as well, besides that, is that they were together as husband and wife, naked. And there's nothing wrong with that. Nothing wrong with that at all. That's, again, looking at the teaching from 1 Corinthians 7, that's precisely what we should do to satisfy that bodily need. Okay. Well, let's talk now about, this is question 10, and we could spend a lot of time on this, and I really wanted to talk about this because I think this is extremely relevant to our culture, and it's something that we need to be firmly, firmly grounded on. When I say the definition or the biblical definition of marriage, Genesis 2 needs to be the passage that pops up in our minds. That's the one. Again, chapter 1 of Genesis gives us the creation account as a whole, but Genesis 2 gives us the specifics of the making of man. And when I say man, I mean human, not just literal man, but man and woman. That's not found in chapter 1. And so when we talk about the family being one of God's three divine institutions, which we believe that it is, as we said at the first of these studies, then since God is the one who made it and instituted it, He's the one who gets to define what family is. Now, why is that so critical nowadays that we understand that? What's happening in our culture? All right, there are several ways in which society is trying to undermine the biblical family, and not just undermine it, but redefine it so that these other relationships can have some social acceptance. And if you don't accept it, if you don't tolerate it, if you don't give it some sort of sanction, what are you? From our side of it, you're a bigot. You're a homophobe, as the saying is. You're discriminatory. See, all those things come into play. So I want to take just a few minutes and talk about this from this angle. And I'm not trying to be political here. I'm really not. But there is a certain amount of politics involved that we need to understand exactly what's being taught. Would you agree, the first part of question 10, would you agree that Genesis 2 defines what the family is? Yes, I would. That is where we have the definition. This text must be seen as the primary defining passage on marriage and all of the Scripture. And then if you couple alongside that at Matthew 19, verses 4 and 5, two places Jesus said, remember, He had that discussion with the Pharisees. Is it lawful for a man to divorce his wife for any cause? And so they had that talk. And in two places in Matthew 19, at verse 4 and at verse 8, Jesus used the phrase, what? At or from the beginning. What's he pointing back to? Genesis chapter 2. That's where he's pointing. He didn't go to the law, did he? Why didn't he go to the law? They brought Moses up. Why did Moses then command to give her a writing of divorcement? Well, no, that's not the place to start. The place to start is where God made the family at the beginning. Or from the beginning, it was not so. So we need to go back to the place where it is defined to see what's going on. Now, this is important, as I say, because efforts have long been underway and succeeding in redefining marriage. And I thought of two particularly, current and social ways in which we see this done. Take, for example, every April 15th, what do you have to do? We just love that day, don't we? We got to pay our taxes. Or every 10 years, what happens in this country? They have a census. All right, so both of those are managed, or they function at the behest of the government. So whether you pay your taxes and you check one of the ways in which you can file your taxes, or when they come and count your house, what is the government willing to accept in terms of a family? Well, here's this house, and here's this man, and here's this woman. They got a bunch of kids running around. But guess what? They may not be married. But what's the government say? Well, to us, that's a family. We're going to count that as a family. Right? That's what they do. That's what can happen. So see, there's a way. Now, I would admit that's somewhat subtle, but here's a government sanction, okay, that says, you know, we don't really care whether you're married or not. We're going to count that as a family. Well, cohabitation. What's God say about that? Does God have a view on that? Well, He does. There's that ever-present Hebrews 13, verse 4. Marriage is honorable among all, and the bed undefiled. The only place the bed is undefiled is in marriage. See, our views don't match. Our views don't match. Well, that's our next point, Brother Miller. But this is separate than the homosexual agenda. This is just basic economics. But our government, and I'm not trying to pick on the, but I'm just saying there is a level of acceptance of this from the standpoint of counting the citizenry of the country. They don't care whether you're married or not. So that's one way that it's being undermined and trying to be redefined, other than the biblical definition. Now, the other way, of course, is the more well-known, I think, it's the homosexual movement. How powerful is the homosexual political lobby machine in this country? You think we know just how powerful it is? I bet we don't. I bet we don't know who all in the halls of Congress are in line with this. It would probably shock us. But it's there. It leaks out every once in a while. Okay. Basically, what is the homosexual movement after? What do they want? They want rights. What kind of rights? I'm just like you. Now, here's two men. Well, we love each other. Here's two women. Well, we love each other. And we've gone somewhere, and they've gotten somebody to marry them. See, what's happening among states now? Some of them are saying, you come to us and we'll marry you. We accept it. See, we're not discriminatory like those bigots out there. Okay? We'll accept you. So we'll marry you. And we'll call you a family. Because you have every much as right to get married as a man and a woman. Heterosexual marriage and homosexual marriage are on the same par, they say. Okay? Now, the homosexual movement has long succeeded in getting legislation passed that is anti-discrimination. And I'm like everybody else. I'm as opposed to discrimination as much as the next person is. I don't care whether a person's skin is white or black. I don't care. Or whether his or her gender is male or female. I don't care about any of that. Who's the gospel for? It's for everybody. The Lord will welcome anybody into His kingdom. But what they have done is say, now listen, if you treat us just because of our sexual orientation, which by the way, they say is from who? Well, I didn't choose this. God made me this way, so I can't help it. That's their thinking. then you can't discriminate. And now, especially in Canada, laws are passed that churches can't even preach against homosexuality. If they do, it's labeled as hate speech. Guess what, brethren? That's coming down this way, too. It'll be here. And how many churches you think will cave into that political pressure? It'll happen. It'll happen. So they've already succeeded on that front. That's already on the books. Already there. Now, the movement says they are seeking and have succeeded in some states recognizing same-sex marriages to legitimize their behavior. We want social acceptance. But that's not enough. They also want monetary benefits. If the two homosexuals are married and one of them works for a company, then he wants his partner to be included on all the employee benefit plans, insurance, retirement, all those things. Just like you extend those to the heterosexual spouse, you need to extend those to the homosexual spouse. And if you don't, what is it? It's discrimination. See, that's where this is all headed. And I know I'm not saying anything that you all don't already know, but that's the argument right there. See, this is an attempt. It's all coming back to this. It's an attempt to redefine the family. Now, can we define the family? It's not ours to define. We didn't dream this up. It's the Lord's institution to define. And so I've just asked the question here. Does God have any thoughts on this? Well, He does. These passages, look at Genesis 18 and verse 20. And these are all passages that you're very familiar with, I know. Genesis 18 and verse 20. And of course, it bleeds on into chapter 19. What's happening in Genesis 19? It's the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. But it just didn't happen just like that. There were some things that led up to it, and we've got to go back to the previous chapter to find that out. God dispatched those angels and all that went in with that. But I want you to look at verse 20 of Genesis 18. If you could read that for us, please.
The Lord said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, because their sin is great.
Yeah.
I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it. If they come to me, and if not, I will know. Then the men turned away from there and went towards Sodom, and Abraham still stood before the Lord. Abraham came and said, would you also?
Okay, and then we start the process of Abraham trying to spare the city, because what was Abraham's concern? Well, Lot's out there. I don't want him, getting destroyed with the rest of them. So he begins to, I don't want to say bargain with God, but he begins to negotiate with God, and he couldn't even find how many. Couldn't even find 10 righteous souls. Now, verse 20 is what I want to emphasize. God says that the cry of Sodom has come up against me, for their wickedness is greater, their sin is great. It's been argued in the past by some who say, well, yes, the Bible does talk about the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah, but their sin, now you may chuckle when you hear this, but I'm not making this up, I promise. Their sin that God was so aware of was a lack of hospitality. That's what was argued. Was that a case? Did that happen when they got into the city? Was there a lack of hospitality? Well, there was. There was. Remember where Lot was going to stay? Out in the open square. And what did the men of the city say? But basically, you better not stay out here. It's going to be a beast. You come in here. So that was the argument. That was the cry out from Sodom. It was a lack of being hospitable. Well, that doesn't even pass the laugh test, because we have the book of Jude. Turn to Jude. Of course, just one chapter. Okay. Jude, verses 5 through 7. Wayne, when you have that, would you read that for us? And pay careful attention, especially to verse 7, I believe it is. Now, in verse 6, he says, there were angels who didn't keep their proper domain. What did God do? He cast them into chains reserved for darkness. So he's talking about judging those who are worthy of being judged. You get to verse 7, he mentions Sodom. Now, what did they do based on verse 7? They went after strange flesh. That's not hospitality. No, of course not. I mean, it just doesn't pass. That argument is extremely flawed. Other passages, the book of Romans chapter 1, the book of 1 Corinthians chapter 6, we could stack the verses up that talk about how God feels about homosexuality. He's opposed to it. Romans 1, Paul says that men leaving the natural use of the woman, committing what is shameful, burning and desiring one for another. It's not natural. It's shameful. And it's condemning. Yes, buddy.
In Genesis 1:28, be fruitful, multiply, and replenish the earth. There's no way homosexuals
can't
do that. And if everyone was like them just within a generation or two, life on earth would cease.
Right. I mean, there's just so many ways in which that is just not in harmony with the definition of family. All right? So Genesis 2 is an extremely, extremely important passage. It tells us what the family is. So when someone says, what is the definition of family? Well, we need to go to the Bible for that and see it from the start. Yes. Yes. Man needs to have his own wife. Woman have her own husband. Okay. So the biblical definition of family must be respected. And when it comes under attack, it needs to be defended. But we're in for some rough sailing in our country. I mean, we are. Not just on this level, but on a lot of levels. But this particularly. The family has been under assault and under attack for, I won't just say years, probably decades. And it's up to who to set the way? Those who are God's people. We have to respect the family. Okay. Any closing comments from anybody? We'll finish this one last question. Question 11 before we get to the next section of the Lord willing on Wednesday night. Thank you all for your comments.